Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the first legislation ever to put a cap on carbon emissions. It was a big political victory for the president, but one with big critics on the right and the left. On cost, on impact, on whether it even addresses global warming. This hour on Point, we'll look at what's in the American Clean Energy and Security Act and what it means for climate change. You can join the conversation. What's your understanding of the climate bill? Are you clear on what cap and trade really means? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington is John Broder. He's a reporter for the New York Times who's been covering the climate bill in Congress. His piece in today's paper takes a close look at the horse trading behind the House bill's passage. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jane.
How much of a landmark was the bill that passed the House on Friday?
Well, it's a major, major step forward. It's the very first time that either House of Congress has actually put a price on carbon dioxide emissions and other global warming gases. It is the beginning of the process, not the end of the process, and it has a long way to go through the Senate where it's not likely to get stronger. But there's a very good chance that a bill putting some sort of price on the emissions of greenhouse gases will be on the president's desk this year or in the first half of next year.
In fact, here he is speaking on Monday afternoon, delivering remarks on energy at the White House. He highlighted the Clean Energy and Security Act as a historic accomplishment, as you say, in the nation's energy policy.
Just last Friday, the House of Representatives came together to pass an extraordinary piece of legislation that will finally open the door to decreasing our dependence on foreign oil, preventing the worst consequences of climate change, and making clean energy the profitable kind of energy. Thanks to members of Congress who are willing to place America's progress before the usual Washington politics, this bill will create new businesses, new industries, and millions of new jobs, all without imposing untenable new burdens on the American people or America's businesses. In the months to come, the Senate will take up its version of the energy bill, and I am confident that they, too, will choose to move this country forward.
That's President Obama speaking on energy on Monday, calling this an extraordinary piece of legislation. John Broder, your piece in the New York Times today, however, says this bill is fat with compromises, concessions, and out-and-out gifts intended to get the votes of wavering lawmakers and the support of powerful industry. Is this bill riddled with giveaways, and how intense were the negotiations?
Well, first of all, the negotiations were as intense as anything I've seen in 20 years in Congress, and I've talked to a number of the members who were directly involved, including Chairman Waxman and Mr. Markey, and they've never seen anything like it either. This bill grew from 648 pages in March to over 1,400 pages by the time it was voted on Friday, and each one of those pages contained something for somebody. Now, does it still maintain its environmental goals, its environmental integrity? To a large extent, yes. But there are provisions in there that over time, if fully taken advantage of by industry and agriculture, could weaken it.
Where are the political lines drawn on this, John? I mean, where do you think the more moderate Republican and independent senators like John McCain and Joe Lieberman, where do they come down on this bill?
Well, McCain and Lieberman, as you know, have in the past sponsored climate change legislation. It's not as far-reaching as the bill that came out of the House Friday night. But Mr. McCain is going to be under tremendous pressure from his right. He faces a challenge in Arizona next year in his reelection to stand firm against the Democrats, to insist on a climate policy, if any, that's more friendly to business and lower cost to consumers. It's going to be a very tough fight in the Senate because, as we saw in the House, this issue breaks along geographic lines almost more than ideological lines, and the Midwestern Democrats are going to be the tough group to round up.
While calling this an extraordinary piece of legislation, President Obama himself has voiced some concerns over parts of the bill. What are those concerns primarily?
Well, To a large extent, he hasn't been specific about what he likes and what he doesn't like. His chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, said that there were some not-so-great provisions in there without specifying what they were. But in an interview with a small group of reporters, including me on Sunday, he singled out one, which would require the United States to impose trade sanctions or tariffs on countries that do not impose carbon limitations on their own industries. For instance, if the United States passes a bill like this, raising the cost of electricity and producing heavy goods like steel, and China does not, the president will be required to levy sanctions, tariffs, on imported steel from China. Mm-hmm. He's uncomfortable with that. It may be illegal.
Mm-hmm. One of the big reasons the president is so adamant about passing this bill, whether or not there are parts of it he doesn't like, is that the administration wants to take this to international negotiations on climate change in Copenhagen in December. I mean, don't they want to be able to take something to show U.S. intentions internationally?
Absolutely, and that was one of the reasons that he spoke out strongly in favor and lobbied hard for this bill. He wants to have some sort of tangible sign that this country has never given before. You know, they rejected the Kyoto Protocol by a unanimous vote of the Senate. George Bush, for 8 years, refused to accept any mandatory limits on greenhouse gases. He wants to be able to say to his counterparts in the developed and developing worlds that Congress is serious. They have passed a bill that takes us, you know, to 80% below current levels by the middle of the century. And while it still needs a little buffing and polishing in the Senate, I'm confident we'll have it. In some ways, he may be better off just taking this House bill to Italy next week for the G8 and to Copenhagen for the UN talks than to see what happens in the Senate, where, as I said earlier, it's not likely to get stronger.
It is not likely to get stronger. In fact, do you think it will pass at all?
I think some version of energy and climate legislation will pass the Senate, perhaps as early as the fall. Then the fun begins, which is conference committee. You know, it'll be very important to see who's named to the conference committee in both the Senate and the House, and both parties, where they're from geographically, where they're from ideologically, and what they can come up with. It's going to take months.
John Broder is a reporter for The New York Times in Washington, D.C. John, I appreciate your time and your perspectives. Thanks.
Happy to do it.
Joining me now from Williamstown, Massachusetts, is Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she has reported extensively on climate change. Her most recent piece, The Catastrophist, profiles climate scientist and activist James Hansen. Betsy, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me in the studio is Robert Stavins, a top environmental economist. He's a professor of business and government at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he directs the program on environmental economics. He also co-chairs the Harvard Project on International Climate Agreements. Robert Stavins, nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Betsy, let me start with you. You just heard how this bill is being negotiated in Washington. Tell us what's in it. What are the key elements?
Well, the fundamental key element is a cap on carbon emissions. I mean, that was the whole point, that we're going to have a sort of aggregate cap on carbon emissions that is supposed to go down over time, and then we're going to apportion those credits to big emitters. That was a huge source of contention, exactly, you know, whether they're going to pay for them, whether they're going to get them free. And then that in turn, and, you know, Rob is the expert on that, it basically puts a price, as John said, puts a price on carbon emissions. So what was once, you know, essentially free, you just dump carbon into the air, now has a price tag associated with it. And I think that just about everyone who's studied this issue would agree that that is the fundamental step that has to be taken in one way or another. Cap and trade is only one way of doing it. There are other ways of doing it, but attaching a price to carbon emissions is the fundamental part of this bill. Now, along with that, as John pointed out, you know, there's 1,200 other pages of stuff, and that stuff is very complicated. Some of it, basically, my understanding is, has the effect of sort of undermining that basic point. There's a huge provision for how you can, in a sense, almost get around actually reducing your own emissions. There's a large provision for offsets, purchasing off what are called offsets, which are instead of my reducing my emissions, I basically pay to have emissions reduced somewhere else. Mm. That's a very tricky business, rather unregulated at this point, unclear to what extent those are really effective.
Back to the cap and trade program, the centerpiece of this, Rob Stavins. I mean, during the campaign, President Obama said that all permits for cap and trade should be sold at auction. And this bill essentially gives away 85% of the permits for free at the outset of the program. Does that undercut this bill's integrity?
Well, no. As John Broder correctly said, there was a great deal of horse trading that led to the passage of the legislation. Some of that horse trading is benign in its effects, and that is it doesn't compromise environmental performance or drive up costs. And other aspects of that horse trading does affect environmental performance and costs. An aspect that doesn't is this issue of whether the permits are auctioned or given away for free. That essentially neither affects the environmental performance, the cap, nor does it drive up the cost of the
program. It's not a concession to corporations?
Well, it's a concession in the fact that it certainly makes them happy, but again, it doesn't drive up costs for the country as a whole, and it doesn't reduce environmental performance. It is a way of building a political coalition. It's the same way we did it in 1990 for the Clean Air Act amendments in the SO2 allowance trading program. You pass out the allowances in a way that create the coalition to pass the legislation.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the first cap-and-trade bill to pass in Congress. Robert Stavins is with us. He's a top environmental economist at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Betsy Colbert is also with us. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she writes extensively about climate change. I was interested, actually, in the New York Times today, Thomas Friedman's column, and his argument in the New York Times, as I said, that this may not be the best bill or the strongest bill, but putting a price on carbon emissions with this cap-and-trade component is a good first step in that it forces the government to put a price on carbon. And even a weak price ushers in a new mindset among consumers and investors and farmers and innovators and entrepreneurs that in time, Betsy Colbert, will make a big difference, much like the first warnings that cigarettes could cause cancer. What do you make of that? Do you agree?
Yes, I think that, you know, I think that many people who follow this issue closely agree with Tom. It's like, it was a bad bill, let's pass it. I mean, that I think is a sort of widespread view. I mean, it is a very, it's not a very strong bill. The interim targets are pretty low. They're way lower than they really need to be, than the science tells us they need to be. The U.S. is, you know, way behind on this issue. At the same time, we just need to get going. And so I think that there was a sense among a lot of people and a lot of, you know, advocates that I spoke to while the debate was going on, you know, look, we know it's a deeply flawed bill, but we know we need to get something done. As you pointed out, you know, going into Copenhagen, we simply need to get started here. Mm-hmm. And if this bill, you know, the train is leaving the station, if this bill didn't pass, it would have not have passed for all the wrong reasons. It wasn't going to not pass because it was too weak. It was going to not pass because actually some people felt it was too strong. Mm. And that was a very frightening prospect to a lot of people. So I think, you know, Tom's view, I essentially agree with that, a very mediocre bill, but absolutely essential.
Robert Stavins, what do you think? I mean, putting this cap and trade provision, putting a price on carbon, does it change the mindset among consumers eventually from an economic perspective?
Well, anyone who's looked at climate change and the incredible challenge that we faced to reduce the threat of climate change because essentially of the ubiquitous nature of energy use in a modern economy recognizes that it's going to be costly to do it, and the only way to do it, not only to do it cost effectively, but just to do it successfully, is going to be by putting a price on carbon. A cap and trade approach is the only politically feasible way in the United States to put a price on carbon. My view is that this bill was not only a major step forward, but it's a step in the right direction, and it's non-trivial. We're talking about putting a price of $15 to $20 per ton of carbon dioxide into the economy by 2020, going up into the hundreds of dollars a ton by 2050. The 2050 targets, which are the important ones, are meaningful. So this is a serious piece of legislation.
Here's President Obama speaking about costs. He devoted his weekly radio address on Saturday to the energy bill. He praised the House for passing it. He said it addressed many of the concerns about costs that have been raised in the past.
Instead of increasing the deficit,
It's paid for by the polluters who currently emit dangerous carbon emissions. It provides assistance to businesses and families as they make the gradual transition to clean energy technologies. It gives rural communities and farmers the opportunity to participate in climate solutions and generate new income. And above all, it will protect consumers from the costs of this transition, so that in a decade, the price to the average American will be just about a postage stamp a day.
Just about a postage stamp a day. Betsy Colbert, is that realistic? Will transition costs average the American, 39 cents a day, 2020?
I have to say that I really don't feel capable of, giving you the economic analysis. People have come up with, different figures, none of them terribly significant to the average consumer. But, I think that the point that has to be made is, on the one hand, you can say, well, that's terrific, we don't want this to actually cost anyone. But if you want to influence people's decision-making, the whole point is it's got to cost people something. I mean, if it's just insignificant and not noticeable and negligible in a postage stamp, then are you really going to change your consuming decisions? Mm-hmm. Now, it's aimed, in a sense, at the big emitters who are really, who are making those decisions based on, buying, tons and tons of energy, not on, your purchases at the gas station, which is going to affect very, very marginally, so marginally that you won't notice, it among the daily fluctuations of gas prices. But if we really, want to send an economic signal, then it has to affect people in their pocketbooks in some way.
Robert Stavins, what do you think? Does this bill, in fact, put the burden on energy companies? Should they bear the full cost? Should Americans bear more of the burden, as Elizabeth says?
Well, inevitably, the costs of this or any kind of energy policy go on to consumers for the most part. The way this legislation is structured is that by the year 2020, the cost is going to be approximately $175 per household per year on average. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office, which is the best analysis I've seen. But recognize that for low-income consumers, it's not $175 per household. It's actually negative 40. That is, they receive $40 per household. So it's a highly progressive piece of legislation. Whereas on the one hand, Betsy is absolutely correct that consumers and businesses have to experience essentially the price of carbon in their energy bills. That doesn't mean that we can't compensate them. We can't insulate them. That's wrong to insulate them from the price increase, but we can compensate them for it separately. And therefore, the cost can be kept down as long as you simultaneously allow energy prices to increase.
Mm. Here's a call from Amherst, Massachusetts. Carl is on the line. Carl, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. This is a great panel. I'm happy to hear it. I have one question which I think has already been answered and another question which I'll ask after first. My understanding is that the bill passed by the House has a safety valve of about $26 per ton on carbon. And if that's true, I'm reminded of another program that you had recently with the wind industry representatives mm-hmm. who said that wind would be competitive at about $40 per ton of carbon. Are we basically like sabotaging ourselves by not making the bill strong enough?
Hmm. And second question quickly, Carl.
Okay, the second question is that if the bill doesn't pass in the Senate, it seems to me that Obama has other means of influencing the price of carbon. For example, since the EPA the government has recognized that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, mm-hmm. The EPA could set limits without congressional approval, and the Department of the Interior could raise the cost of mineral rights for companies that extract carbon from the ground.
Hmm. All right, Carl, thank you. First question to you, Professor Stavins. Are we sabotaging this bill by not making it stronger, given the cost per ton of carbon?
So Carl's correct that there is something like a safety valve mechanism in the bill that in rather strange ways would have the effect of limiting the cost of allowances. But that essentially escalates over time, so it doesn't reduce the effectiveness of the legislation over the long term. It's true that as a result of the endangerment finding, EPA is empowered with some pretty powerful regulatory abilities to regulate carbon dioxide across the board. My hope would be that we leave that to the federal legislation from the Congress within a cap and trade system so we do it cost effectively.
Here's Wes. He's in Burlington, Vermont. Wes, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to ask Betsy Colbert about I know that James Hansen says we have a decade within which to get from 385 parts per million of carbon dioxide back down to 350. And yet this bill, as I understand it, calls for only 20% cuts by 2020, which is a hopelessly inadequate. I wonder if she could comment on that.
Wes, thank you. James Hansen is a scientist that you profiled in The New Yorker, the world-renowned scientist, James Hansen.
Well, I just want to say that Wes is partly right. I mean, Jim would say that we need to we have 10 years basically to sort of turn things around, but he wouldn't say that you have 10 years to get CO2 levels from their current level of about 385 parts per million to 350, because, to be frank, that would be impossible. It takes a long, long time, to sort of bring CO2 levels down, which is one of the problems, and I think that Jim feels that realistically, you know, we would be very, 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 very lucky to, peak. You have what we call sort of an overshoot scenario, where you go over the CO2 concentration that you think is safe, and then hopefully you gradually begin to pull that down. If we could peak CO2 levels at around 400 or 425, we would be very, very lucky if we then started to pull them down. But, the time frame here, and I think that Wes correctly identified the problem here, which is that the science and the politics, do not match up. The science suggests to us that we have already reached a dangerous level of CO2, that we have, very little time to start to turn that around. And this bill does not, take strong enough action. You also have, the whole rest of the world to deal with. And this is the heart of the matter. How do you make what's scientifically demanded and what's politically possible come together? And it's, when you look at both parts of the equation, it's very, very difficult to get the terms to add up.
What about some of these dates, Professor Stavins, that are in this bill? They seem to be really far off in the future. I mean, a lot of the stuff doesn't take effect for years.
And it's actually very important that those dates are in there. One of the shortcomings of the Kyoto Protocol, one of the shortcomings of the approach that the European Union is taking in its emissions trading scheme, is that it is focused only on the short term. Carbon dioxide and these other greenhouse gases are stock environmental problems. That is, we're concerned about the amount of water in the bathtub, not the amount of water that's coming out of the faucet at any moment in time. It's the concentrations. And because these greenhouse gases have long lag times in the atmosphere, decades to centuries, it means that it's a long-term problem. And that 2050 focus is actually very important. Now, Betsy mentioned about the politics and the science not lining up. The economics and the politics line up a bit better, although by no means perfectly. And I say that because the economics of the problem would tell us that it's best to ramp up gradually. And that's because we want to achieve stabilization in the atmosphere at safe levels, but do it in ways that we do not unnecessarily render large parts of the capital stock of our economy prematurely obsolete.
What about during time of economic crisis, as we're in now, a recession?
Well, actually, one of the marvelous properties of a cap-and-trade system is that it is what an economist would call countercyclical. At a time at which there is recession, as we now see in Europe, then the allowance prices fall because they're no longer binding. So, in fact, that's one of the nice properties of the approach that is in the Waxman-Markey legislation, is that during times of economic growth, allowance prices will go up. When there is a decrease in economic growth or recession, allowance prices will fall.
Here's Stefan. He's calling from Walcott, Iowa. Stefan, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you, Jane.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Question is, how much do you think that this bill does to stem the industrial exodus that we have of companies leaving this country to avoid EPA mandates and things like that on their emissions? I mean, if we're going to let our companies move to other countries so that they can basically do whatever they want as far as their emissions, does this bill really attack that and put tariffs on them to make it a more level playing field?
Stefan, thanks. Betsy, Stefan's concerned about industrial exodus with this bill.
Well, that was obviously, the impetus, and I certainly would defer to Rob on the economic implications of that. That was certainly the impetus for the notion that after 2020 we were going to, put a tariff on goods coming from countries that had not taken similar actions. And the problem of, you know, what's known in climate circles as leakage, where you don't actually reduce emissions, you just push them into different places, you know, is a serious one. Now, you know, we've already lost so many manufacturing jobs. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how many we have left to lose. Perhaps, you know, some people would argue by forcing our industries to become more efficient or you know, prodding our automakers, for example, to build more efficient cars, maybe we're really helping them out. But once again, I'm gonna defer to Rob on that one.
Well, let me ask you about this tariffs aspect of the bill, because at the top of the program, John Broder mentioned President Obama has concerns about that aspect of the bill. What about Paul Krugman's view in the New York Times today, Rob, that there's sound economics behind the tariff idea, that not charging tariffs would just encourage Americans to continue buying cheaper imported products without paying for elimination of pollution?
Well, as usually, the question is whether there is a better way of addressing the concern. First of all, let's recognize that this issue of international competitiveness that Stefan has raised is a huge political issue. It is actually less of an economic issue. Now, it is for a small set of highly energy-intensive, trade-sensitive sectors of the economy, rolled steel, glass, cement, aluminum, and a few others. There is a way to deal with these which doesn't bring up the problems of tariffs, and that's actually in the legislation. It's a, I hate to go to jargon, but it's an output-based updating allocation mechanism.
I saw you go to the notes for that. That makes me feel better.
And that mechanism is one whereby it lowers the production costs of those companies in particular sectors.
Well, that's basic.
It has problems, but that's the way it's done in the legislation.
Would proper tariffs level the playing field rather than being protectionist?
Well, tariffs are also in the legislation, and tariffs like that approach will have the effect of leveling the playing field. The problem is that tariffs can also raise the specter of a trade war. Mm. You know, it's not very long ago that the president of France announced that he would like to place tariffs against the United States for our exports because we have not ratified the Kyoto Protocol. We felt a little differently then about the notion of tariffs. So yes, they can work, but even if they are compliant with the World Trade Organization rules, which is not clear. Nevertheless, they're a very risky approach.
Betsy Colbert, this notion of a trade war concerning to you?
Well, I think there's something when as Rob pointed out, you know, the European Union raised the prospect that there should be a tariff against us. I mean, I think that there have to be consequences. This is one of the real problems for, you know, an international agreement, for example. What are the consequences of not doing anything? And, you know, if people are going to really actually make good faith efforts to reduce emissions, then there have to be consequences for those countries that don't. And, you know, I'm certainly not a trade expert, so I don't really want to claim to be. But I think that trade sanctions are one of the few, you know, things that happen to get countries' attention. So I guess I would argue we can't really afford to leave them out of the arsenal of potential sanctions.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the cap-and-trade bill that passed in Congress last week. Elizabeth Colbert is with us. She writes about climate change for The New Yorker. Robert Stavins is with us as well. He's director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and a top researcher on international climate agreements. Let's go back to the phones. First, in Savannah, Georgia, Mark is on the line. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of energy independence somewhat bothers me, and I think it was on Bloomberg that there's a report about this cap-and-trade bill would increase our dependence on foreign oil due to its tax-like structure.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Mark, thank you. There are a lot of conservatives who say the cap-and-trade policies do nothing to foster energy independence, make us more dependent on foreign oil, as the caller suggests. Betsy?
Wow, I don't get that logic. I mean, any time you know, the ultimate goal of this is to get us to reduce our use of carbon-based fuels, so, you know, you would assume that we would be reducing, and there are projections of how much you would, in fact, reduce oil use under this bill. So I don't see how it could make us more dependent on foreign oil, but perhaps I'm missing something. I'd be interested to know what possible mechanism there is for that.
Professor Stavins?
Well, I can guess at what the logic is behind that, but it turns out it's empirically incorrect. So the logic is that when you put a price on carbon, you're punishing coal a lot more than you're punishing petroleum or natural gas. Now, if you punished coal with an extremely high charge relative to petroleum, then it's conceivable that in the extreme, you would see reduced reliance on coal-fired sources of electricity generation, increased reliance on petroleum for generating electricity, which we don't do much of in the United States, but is done in other parts of the world. But the empirical realities of this is that this legislation, what we're looking at in the trajectories going forward, will reduce demand for all three fuels, particularly relative to renewable sources.
Mm. Betsy Colbert, it seems nobody is heralding this bill that passed the House on Friday as ideal or even enough. As we've said, they're praising it for its political feasibility. I'm curious, what do climate scientists want to see in this bill that was left out?
Well, you know, I think climate scientists have tended to say, as scientists generally do, and you know, you could argue that's one of the problems of our situation, our job is not to tell you what should be in the legislation. In fact, that was sort of one of the themes of my piece on Jim Hansen. He's taken a very unusual step for a scientist to say, and in fact, he condemned the Markey Waxman bill that we've been talking about as inadequate. But in general, climate scientists have taken the position, look, we tell you the science, you decide the policy. Now, I think you know, what is coming out of the scientific world would suggest, if you draw the logical inference, that the bill is inadequate. But I don't think there were many climate scientists out there, you know, commenting directly on the legislation.
What other interest groups, what do other interest groups want in this bill, Professor Stavins, that was taken out?
Well, it's striking that some of the changes in the legislation that took place at the last minute, I guess it was at 3 o'clock in the morning on Friday morning, in order to get some additional votes, are ones that present potential problems, ones that are not benign, to use the word I used earlier, but rather that can reduce environmental performance and or drive up costs. One is that the House of Representatives decided, with regards to the tariff provision, that rather than leaving it up to a presidential prerogative, which is the way it was originally, that the president would be required to take action under certain circumstances. And President Obama correctly in the White House on Sunday complained about that change. The other is something that was referred to earlier, which are these agricultural offsets. As a result of the interest from mainly the Midwest, but from the Agriculture Committee in the House, much more liberal provisions were included in the late draft for so-called offsets from agriculture. This is different than the cap and trade. This means that if it's very costly for a firm to reduce emissions, it can buy a so-called offset from agriculture. But those agriculture entities are not under the cap. Rather, if they reduce their emissions below what they normally would be, they thereby generate a credit. Problem. Who knows what they normally would be? It's an unobserved and unobservable hypothetical. This raises what is referred to as the additionality problem. Are you really getting anything additional? Furthermore, non-point source emissions from agriculture are notoriously difficult to measure, let alone emissions reductions, which are fundamentally not visible. So the concern is an environmental one, and environmental advocacy groups are right to be concerned about this.
Let's go to Heartland, Vermont. Kenny is on the line. Kenny, welcome to On Point.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I got a couple concerns here.
Okay.
One is, you know, we're trying to legislate a problem that there isn't even complete consensus on as to what the problem is, and how to fix it. I look at this as another giant government boondoggle. It's going to come loaded with unintended consequences and unfunded mandates, for consumers and businesses and everything else. I can't point to any government program that's run responsibly and run well as it is now. And we're going to take on something like this at a legislative level. I own some rental property, and I've got some incubator businesses that are working on this. People are working on it. Nobody, people aren't just sitting on their hands waiting for the government to fix it. Hmm. And you know, if the government jumps in here and puts all this, all these rules and regulations in, it's going to stifle what's going on in the private sector. I've talked to some of these people that are working on it now, and they're scared to death. The government's going to jump way ahead of them. They're going to stifle innovation. And you know, if people work on this stuff and they don't need the government to guide them along here, it's just going to be.
Kenny, I hear it. The giant government boondoggle with mandates is Kenny's concern. Professor Stavins?
So I think most economists would share Kenny's general concern about the federal government trying to move into the private sector and not doing it very well. What's important to recognize is that this is not conventional government regulation. This is not a large set of standards. What it is essentially trying to put a price on carbon, which is a way of harnessing market forces. So it's working through the market, not against the market. That's why this is a promising approach.
Betsy Stavins, Kenny also worries that there is not consensus about what the problem really is. Is that your sense from your reporting?
Yeah, I just have to disagree with that. I mean, that's a sort of canard that we're going to just keep hearing throughout this debate. But in scientific terms and in the relevant scientific community, I mean, once again, there's a bit of confusion. Do all scientists agree with this? You know, not necessarily, but the same way that, you know, you wouldn't go to, you know, a weatherman for heart surgery, you know, you wouldn't go to a heart surgeon to ask for an opinion about climate science. And in the relevant scientific community, those who study the climate, there is virtual unanimity about this problem. And in fact, I think that the scientific people in the scientific community would tell you that, in fact, they're only growing more and more concerned. The evidence that's coming in about how quickly the climate is, in fact, changing, how quickly the world is changing in response to the greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere, is actually happening even more quickly than many of the models had predicted. So if anything, you know, the problem is more serious than the scientific published scientific consensus would have you believe. But, you know, in the scientific world, there really is consensus on this problem.
Let's go to Orleans, Massachusetts. Dana is on the line. Welcome to On Point, Dana.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
And your guests. That last speaker sort of hit on just, I think, a lot of the problem is. I take the opposite tack. I think the problem is big business and it's greed for profit. I mean, I have no faith in good faith or enlightened self-interest or any of the rhetoric that business uses to pretend to express concern for such a growing and deadly serious problem as is climate. I call it climate disruption.
So you think Dana, we're looking out for big business profits as much as we're looking out for the environment?
Yes, because I think they can flex their muscles and they're able to really intimidate the whole issue, you know, the whole process of dealing with the issue. And that's my point, is we definitely, I don't even believe in cap and trade. I believe stop the emissions. We have federal mandates to either curb, maybe we can do it gradually if we have to, but they have to stop. And we have to, you know, hold business and all polluters, including myself, accountable for, you know, their actions, and we have to put a curb on it.
Dana, thanks. Too concerned about big business. Professor Stavins?
Well, the reality is that when legislation such as this to address climate change appears to save money for business, what it's actually doing is saving money for consumers, because the reality is that the costs of environmental regulations are passed on to all of us, either as shareholders, as employees, or as customers of products. And it's mainly as customers of products. And so when you see someone talking about that this is going to lower the cost and it's to companies, what that really means, in the way economists look at it, is that it's lowering costs to households.
Hmm. Robert Stavins, you mentioned on your blog that cap and trade, the key provision of this bill, has actually been implemented in other countries for years now, over two decades. How has it worked? How has cap and trade worked around the world?
So we've had a considerable amount of experience with the approach now, and actually the earliest experience was in the United States. So if you'll think back to when we phased the lead out of gasoline in the United States at the same time as the Europeans were doing it through taxation, we did it with a cap-and-trade system among refineries. Mm. And the result was that we saved about $250 million per year in compliance costs, much of that passed down in the price of gasoline. And we got that leaded gasoline out of the marketplace in 5 years faster than anyone thought.
So that was successful?
That was extremely successful. And a second approach that was used was when we cut acid rain by 50% under the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. That's done through a cap-and-trade system. It's also been highly successful.
And how's it worked around the world?
So outside of the United States, the use of cap-and-trade has been more limited for pollution. The most striking use of it has been in the European Union in their emission trading scheme for carbon dioxide. They, in the early phases, which were the pilot phase, had problems because of the design of the system, but it didn't result in environmental degradation. It just didn't function as well as it could have. But in the real phase, the Kyoto phase, which started January 2008, it's functioning very well.
Back to the phones. Giles is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Giles, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Hello. Well, go ahead.
A younger person, and I realize that if we don't do something now, then it absolutely is going to affect the future, and I support this bill wholeheartedly, but I'm afraid that it is not enough, and we need to do so much more. So my question is, if this does go through, what is the likelihood or even the possibility that stronger legislation will come out in the near future saying, yes, this was good, we like where this is going, let's go even further? Mm.
Giles, thanks. It's a good question. Betsy Colbert?
Well, I think that is a good question, and I think that, you know, one of the, you know, sort of hold-your-nose parts of this legislation is, given how, you know, how hard it was to pass it and how much horse trading had to go in, a lot of people are very concerned, look, we're going to do this. We're not revisiting this for a while, so we better get it right. Now, another school of thought, I suppose a more perhaps hopeful school of thought, is we get this passed, we get it in place, it turns out to function well and actually not be very burdensome to people. We find that there are many, many efficiencies in the system that can actually, you know, sort of save businesses money, and we wring a lot of the waste out of the system. We realize we can tighten the cap more quickly than is in this legislation. So I suppose as the scientific evidence comes in, and if it suggests that we need to do that, which, you know, I guess I would argue it already suggests that we need to do that. That's the hopeful scenario, and the unhopeful scenario is, you know, if we get this, it's basically all we're going to get, you know, between now and 2050. Now, 2050 is a long, long way from now, and a lot can change. So I really actually think that no one would argue this is it between now and 2050.
What do you think, Professor Stavins?
So I think the most important question with this initial foray is not so much what it leads to next for the United States, but whether or not this has an effect of helping the United States to play a leadership role in international negotiations to put in place a post Kyoto Protocol climate regime that's for post-2012, an international agreement that's meaningful and that includes key, rapidly growing, large developing countries, China, India, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, Korea, and a few others. Without them joining an agreement, without them taking action, none of this is going to make any difference. And in fact, just to put numbers on that to illustrate how great the challenge is, it's not just a matter that it's economically necessary. It is physically impossible to achieve the targets, the 450 parts per million, for example, that Betsy's talked about, even if all of the industrialized world, all of the developing countries except for China and India, if all of those other countries reduce their emissions to zero, I didn't say cut them by 50%. I said reduce to zero. If China and India did not take action, it would be impossible to achieve the 450 parts per million because they are huge countries. They're growing rapidly. We're talking about often double-digit rates of economic growth in rapidly growing developing countries. So that's the key question for me. Does this action by the United States put us back in a credible position vis-a-vis countries of the world to work for a solid and meaningful international arrangement.
Betsy Colbert, I'll give you the last word. What would this energy bill actually do for climate change?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, Rob's point is extremely important. And, you know, if you actually run the numbers and you do, you know, this bill in isolation, as he points out, you know, it doesn't do much. But the question is, you know, are we going to reverse this trajectory which we've been on of essentially, you know, uncontrolled growth in greenhouse gas emissions? And I think the point that people would make is we have to start bringing that line down. You know, it's a line that's been sloping upwards. It needs to come to, it needs to flatten out, and then it needs to start coming down. And the question is, you know, can the world? I mean, this is really the question of our age. It seems to me, faced with, you know, sort of overwhelming scientific evidence, mm-hmm. and as our caller just said before, especially for young people, that this is going to affect our kids and our grandchildren very seriously, can we do what we know is necessary? And we're going to find out, you know?
Elizabeth Colbert is staff writer for The New Yorker. Elizabeth, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Robert Stavins is an environmental economist at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His forthcoming book is Post-Kyoto, International Climate Policy. Thank you, Professor, very much.
Pleasure to be here.
I'm Jane Clayson. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.